The second case for oral argument this morning is Orth versus Stobner and Perman for the appellant. Orth is Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, let's see, are you representing different clients? Is that why you're both arguing? Who do you represent?
No, sir, we represent collectively
both before I hear. Okay, let's see. First one, you're going to have to help me with this name.
Jeffrey Brackavage.
Okay. Brackavage, thank you, because I'd have butchered that pretty badly. You'll do the first 10 minutes, is that correct? All right. And then J.G. Schultz, you'll do the last 10. And both attorneys are from Sioux Falls. The court should note that we've had two disqualifications in this case. Justice Sabers and Justice Konenkamp have disqualified themselves, and the court has appointed the Honorable Max Gores, the presiding judge of the 6th Judicial Circuit, and the Honorable John Bastian, a circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in their places. Court would like to welcome and note the presence this morning of the Bonham County High School, and hope you find this educational. When the argument is completed, we'll have some books for you to take along as souvenirs of your visit, and welcome. With that, Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, counsel, this case arises out of Bonham County, so it's great we have some representatives from Bonham County here today. Dwayne Orth's from Bonham County. He started working construction for the employer in this case in about 1994, and he worked what was considered medium to hard labor. He did shingling, he did lifting, he did carpentry, he did a lot of bending, stooping, pounding, basically crawled all over the houses and other construction sites that they were building. And he was able to do this perfectly. He was perfectly capable of doing this for 6 years. One of the hardest workers they had. Mr. Orth said that these two employers, Dwayne Stubner and Mr. Perman, Steve Perman, were a couple of the best employers he ever had, and they said he was one of the best employees that he's ever had. So this is a very amicable relationship. But about 6 years into this thing, Dwayne Orth started to have severe back problems. He started treating with Dr. Carlson, treated with some of Dr. Benson and other physicians. After 6 years of being able to do virtually everything on this job site, he started not being able to do things. They had to first reduce his work, and then eventually he just could not work at all anymore. The back pain was so bad. And now he wears a back brace and can't do very much of anything. If he rides in a car, he needs to wear a back brace because it hurts so much. He's on permanent total disability.
How old is he now?
Now he's in his 50s, late 50s, I believe. I have to check the record on that.
All right. How old was he when he came to work for Stibner and Perman?
He was, I believe, well, he worked for them for 1994 till 2002. I believe he was in his 40s when he started working there, or maybe he was in his early 50s. I'll have to verify that, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, I'm sure it's in the record, too.
It is in the record. This appeal presents three issues. The first is a procedural issue, and the other two are substantive. And we would suggest that the review of this court is de novo on the ultimate issue in each case. And we believe when the court takes a de novo look, a fresh look at this record, it will conclude, first of all, that the employers did have actual notice of the possibility that there was a compensable event that occurred in this case. Secondly, that Dr. Carlson's medical opinion on causation is sufficient. And third, that Dwayne Orth qualifies for odd lot status and permanent total disability.
How do we get to review something that wasn't decided?
Each issue was noticed for review by each of the parties to the circuit court. Each issue was presented to the Department of Labor and tried to the Department of Labor. And so the Department of Labor was charged with deciding each of these issues, and factual evidence was presented to the Department of Labor on each of these issues. The Department of Labor, because it held that there was no causation established, it did not reach the other two issues. but we believe that the record was presented to the Department of Labor, and this court can find on each of the issues. The circuit court decided two of the issues, decided the notice element or issue, even though that was not decided by the Department of Labor, and we're asking that that be reversed.
But shouldn't the circuit court and this court have the benefit of the fact finder's observation of the live witness testimony?
I would say that that's typically to the court's benefit. I mean, typically that's what you want. I would suggest that in this appeal, the notice issue was tried extensively, and the circuit court has made factual findings on that, even though they're not owed any deference. There have been factual findings made on that issue. We have the hearing transcript. It's been fully briefed. I would suggest that there's no additional evidence that's going to be adduced if it were remanded back on the notice issue or on the odd lot issue.
Is there a credibility issue or anything like that on the notice issue that we need to defer to the fact finder on?
I would suggest not. I would suggest that the employers both have freely admitted that they believed that that Duane's problems were related to work. The testimony at the hearing was that, yes, we assumed that it was related to work. Now, the challenge really came when they were asked by the employer's attorneys, well, you made that assumption, though, not based on any medical evidence or proof or anything that was told to you. You just assumed it was related to work. And they said, yes, we did. They admitted that. Now, we may hear something different when the other side gets up here, but I would suggest the testimony in the record is, in black and white, that they believed that work was causing this. And that's all that's required in order to satisfy the actual notice standard. They just have to be alerted to the possibility that there's a work-related claim.
They don't have to know the extent of the injury or any specifics?
They don't. This court has made clear that the notice statute is really, it's not an escape hatch. It's not a way of escaping liability for an otherwise compensable claim. What it is, it's a very important guarantee that an employer will have an opportunity to investigate a claim if there's an investigation to be done or if it wants to investigate a claim. So it doesn't have to know or have evidence that there is a compensable event. It doesn't have to know that there have medical causation. It doesn't have to have doctor's opinions. All it has to do is be aware something out of the ordinary has occurred, I think, is one of the language quoted in one of this court's cases, so that the possibility of a claim has arisen in the employer's mind or objectively should have been raised in the employer's mind so that they can investigate a claim. And I think it's absolutely clear on this record that that occurred in this case. Whether you look at it subjectively or whether you look at it objectively, most of the cases that this court's dealt with on the actual notice exception have to deal with whether an employer should have been able to piece the evidence together, the Mudlin case or the Striley case. There's evidence that in the record where a reasonable employer objectively should have been able to look at this and say something out of the ordinary has occurred. If we want to do an investigation, we should do it. This case certainly has all that type of evidence you can piece together, but this is an unusual, unique case because here, subjectively, the employers have admitted, yes, this was in our minds. We knew this may be related to work. Yes, we were only assuming that. Yes, we didn't have proof, but we have not just objectively, you should look at this and say, yes, they had enough evidence. We've got admissions from both employers who worked with Duane Orth every day that they saw what was happening to him. They knew he was doctoring. They knew his back had gradually become so painful he had to have his work reduced and then no longer could work. And we admit, yes, in our minds, we connected this to work. And I would suggest as a matter of law, that's notice.
Did the hearing examiner make findings on the notice issue? I know they didn't. She didn't decide it, but did she make findings on it?
There are findings that I would say could be related, yes, to the notice issue.
And what did the trial court rely on then to make its decision with regard to notice?
Trial court relied completely on the cold record.
Not on the findings by the hearing examiner?
I don't believe so. I believe the trial court made its own findings. I'd have to verify that, I guess, for sure. But as I read Judge Eng and his decision, he made additional factual findings. I mean, his own factual findings.
Because notice, if it was tried to the hearing examiner, then the hearing examiner would have the opportunity to judge the credibility of the witnesses. And if they made certain findings, if the hearing examiner made certain findings, then a certain amount of deference should be given to those findings. And that's the purpose of my question.
I would say yes. I would say that factual findings made by the department are owed deference. Factual findings made by the circuit court are not owed deference.
Was the hearing examiner made fully aware that the notice was an issue?
Yes. I believe the notice was the biggest issue at the hearing.
So is there any reason why she doesn't even mention it?
I think there's a judicial canon that if you don't have to decide an issue, you don't usually get to it. And that may have been what the hearing examiner was doing, was saying, I don't have to get to the other issues because I don't find that there's causation. It would have been more helpful if she had.
Did you propose findings on notice to,
yes,
to the hearing examiner?
Yes, we did.
And did Mr. Schultz?
Yes. I think I've talked about notice. I think I've made all the points I wanted to make on notice. I'd like to move on to the causation issue, if that's acceptable. Dr. Carlson was the primary treating physician in this case. Dr. Carlson, Dr. Benson did most of the doctoring in this case. Dr. Carlson generated most of the medical records, and he is the person who treated Dwayne North over the years as this back injury occurred in 2001, 2002. And I would suggest he's the person, other than Dwayne Orth and his wife maybe, who's most familiar with Dwayne Orth's back. After treating Dwayne Orth, examining the medical records, conducting all of these tests, and treating him, Dr. Carlson submitted a medical opinion letter. And that letter states that he cannot determine which of the work-related activities and the degenerative changes that were occurring in Dwayne's spine is the major contributing cause of his injury. He can't determine which of those two is the major contributing cause. But he would assign 50% responsibility to each of those events. I would suggest that 50% responsibility for a person's crippling back injury is, as a matter of law, a major contributing cause of that injury. No factor was, in Dwayne Orr's treating physician's opinion, no factor was a greater factor than his work-related activities. Degenerative changes were equally responsible. And so you have two causes. Now, of course, the law is you do not have to determine which is the major contributing cause because there are very often a combination of things that produce an injury. And that's what happened, I believe, in this case. So that would put us under SDCL 62-1-1, subsection 7B. You have degenerative changes, that's admitted, but you also have work activities, and the combination of those two, under the statute, can produce a compensable injury. Now, Dr. Carlson's letter is not a model of clarity. I did not write the letter. I wish I could have written his opinion letter for him, stating his opinions, but that's not what we have in this case. We have a treating physician who's a busy man. This is not a professional witness. This is a physician who has treated Dwayne, and he had issued a letter saying, I think I would assign 50% responsibility to each. And I would suggest that that is sufficient to establish causation in this case, particularly since there is de novo review on this issue because this issue was decided completely on documentary evidence and deposition, or not even deposition testimony, completely on medical records.
Isn't work-related issues, quote-unquote, as posed in his letter, somewhat nebulous?
It's nebulous if you read it in a vacuum, if you don't know what he's talking about. But, of course, this is the gentleman who's been treating him for this specific injury. I mean, he is the one that Dwayne went to when he couldn't work anymore. He's the person who's been examining Dwayne, and he's the one whose medical records are treating these injuries that occurred while he was at work. So, yeah, I would have loved for it to be more precise, and we probably wouldn't be here if it was more precise. But I think it's still sufficient to establish causation, and And if, when you compare it especially with Dr. Farnham, I mean, what Dr. Farnham does is do independent medical examinations. And he, you know, a lot has been made below that, below was made of the fact that we have a one-page opinion from Dr. Carlson versus a report from Dr. Farnham. But Dr., all the medical records and all the treatment in this case are Dr. Carlson's report. If you look at just what the opinion is, Dr. Farnham's opinion is really not more than a page either. But if you compare the two opinions, you have Dr. Carlson saying, yes, there are definitely degenerative things happening in this man's back, and they have been happening. But also, work-related issues. Over these past 8 years that he's been working for Stubner and Perman, these issues also contributed. 50%, at least, I would. That's what my assignment. Dr. Farnham says it's purely lifestyle. I mean, he looks at this the medical records, and he doesn't see anything that Dr. Carlson apparently sees. He says this is all lifestyle choices. Tobacco use is what caused Dwayne's spine to be damaged, is the primary opinion offered by Dr. Farnham. Now, there's nothing that he puts in the record to document that. There's no scientific evidence saying that tobacco use causes spinal damage of this magnitude. There's no explanation of how that happens. He just says, well, it's just well known. Tobacco use causes spinal damage. 15 years ago, Dwayne smoked, and so I'm saying that the tobacco use caused the spinal damage. And
so this evidence all came in, one as a report and one as a letter. There was never a deposition or live testimony on either expert, is that right?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely. We have medical records and opinion letters from Dr. Carlson. We have a report from Dr. Farnham.
This may be a little ticklish, but how would you distinguish this from the Horn case? Specifically, I recall it was Dr. Benson. Dr. Benson's opinion in Horn, and now we have Dr. Carlson's opinion in this case.
I think very distinguishable. The Horn case just came down. Their short-term compensability was established, and that was the department found short-term compensability, and that was never challenged. Regarding long-term benefits in Horn or long-term compensability, at first Dr. Benson didn't give an opinion, and Dr. Farnham did give an opinion on long-term compensability and what was on whether work-related issues were a major contributing cause. And then when he was deposed and asked whether they were a major contributing cause, he said he couldn't be specific on that issue. And he said, when pressed, he said, oh, I think it is a contributing factor. And so we certainly took the position, I happen to represent, along with Russ Janklo, Mr. Horn in that case, so we took the position that that was enough. But when you compare the two, there's much more evidence on causation in Orth. There, Dr. Benson was only able to say, oh, I think it is a contributing factor, when pressed. Here, we have Dr. Carlson saying, I would assign 50% responsibility to the work-related issues. So I think there's really no comparison of the two cases. Orth is the much stronger case on causation.
What about the argument that this letter somehow really is just a future statement about, you know, someday if somebody asks me, I'll give an opinion? That's been raised by the other side.
I wish I could have written the letter. I wish it didn't say, if asked in the future, I would give it 50% responsibility to work-related issues. I wish he had just said it's 50% each. But if you take it in context, this is Dr. Carlson, who has treated Dwayne for all these past couple of years. He's done all the tests. He's reviewed all the medical records. There's nothing else that he needs to do to arrive at that opinion. He's telling, in his letter, he's saying, this is the conclusion I've arrived at. Now, a lot of times you say, well, this, I would give it this. It's imperfect grammatically. I concede that. I wish it said something more precise. But if you go to the substance of what's being said, which I think we need to do, we need to place substance over form. The substance is, I'm giving causation 50-50. And I that's what I would ask the court to look at. It's supported, by the way, by tremendous factual evidence. The before and after of this man, 6 years into this job, he was working, doing everything he could do. He was all over this work site. Then the back problem started, and now he can't move, essentially. you can't just look at the medical evidence in a vacuum. You also have to look at the factual testimony that backs it up. Just have a few minutes left. I would also suggest on the odd lot issue, there was no contradicting evidence placed by the employer. We had evidence by Dr. Ostrander and three physicians that he's permanently disabled. And the burden shifts when you demonstrate that you're obviously unemployable. And the employer then has the burden to put on evidence that you cannot, that there is employment available. They had the opportunity to do that, and they did not do that. And so I would suggest that this court can rule on that issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Rakowitz, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Jeff Brekevich, and with co-counsel Jeff Schultz, we represent the Appalese Stabner and Furman Construction Company and American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Mr. Schultz and I will be dividing our 20 minutes equally. There are broadly stated three issues before this court. Those are notice, causation, and whether claimant has established that he's permanently disabled. But we believe that there's really just one issue before this court, and that's whether or not reversible error was committed below. And because claimant does not make that showing on appeal, we respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment and dismissal of the workers' compensation petition. Starting the analysis, we'd like to start exactly where the department started, and that was on the issue of causation. And claimant takes a curious position. They're asking the court to consider the documentary evidence within the context of the testimony. Well, on the same hand, though, they're saying that the court should only look at the documentary evidence, and we agree. The issue of causation required expert medical testimony. And on the issue of causation, the only expert medical testimony that claimant offered was an eight-line letter. The eight-line letter says that it was
but
not
we
possible.
Don't necessarily review this on which weighs the most, do we? When there's evidence that comes in, it's what's more persuasive.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the department considered that and correctly considered Dr. Farnham's report to be
would
more
persuasive. Would you talk
persuasive.
About Farnham's opinion? My understanding is that he based his opinion that the smoking caused it? Can you kind of explain how he got to that result?
Your Honor, we believe that it's fully set forth in his report. And contrary to the way that it's been spun or represented, an analysis of his report, as we explained in our brief, shows that he said that there are a number of factors and that primarily this was a degenerative condition. And that's something that everyone agrees on. All the medical providers here, in looking through the medical records, you see that it's replete with references to degenerative disc disease. Not a low back condition, not an undefined problem, but degenerative disc disease.
But that wouldn't necessarily, just that diagnosis wouldn't necessarily mean it's not, this injury isn't work-related. That doesn't automatically get you out of workers' comp, because take your worker as they are, and everybody at some age starts to have some degenerative diseases in their joints. So
absolutely, Your Honor, you're correct. And I guess getting more back to the smoking issue too, one of the reasons that Dr. Carlson may not have made any reference to smoking is that if you look through the medical records on the questionnaires from Orthopedic Institute, the claimant indicated that he never smoked. So that really also creates a situation where the foundation of Dr. Carlson's opinions, even if this could be characterized as an expert medical opinion, is dubious at best. This court has repeatedly dealt with expert medical testimony, and some of the hallmarks of reliability are a reference to the specific condition in question. The claimant here had other medical issues. He had ankle problems. He certainly had degenerative disc disease, but based upon this letter from March 5, 2002, there's no way to tell exactly what the work activities being referred to are or what the condition is. And more importantly, there's no causal link or nexus between work activities with Stabner and Perman Construction Company and the claimant's condition. That's the causal link that this court requires.
Well, it says it's work-related, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Well, he only had one job, and that was with your client, didn't he? I mean, he wasn't working three different construction jobs.
No, but he had a long work history, and he had been receiving treatments for back pain since at least 1976. His employer before Stabner and Perman Construction was another construction company, and the record should reflect that while he worked for that employer, he hurt his back while working on a roof throwing shingles.
But I thought he was up on the roof putting shingles down with your clients, all three of them side by side.
And, Your Honor, the record shows that. But what we don't have from Dr. Carlson's letter is any reference to specific activities or work activities. The court...
Do they have to be more specific than simply work-related?
Your Honor, we believe that more is required. The claimant here bears the burden of proof on this, and it's not just an ordinary burden. It's a burden to come forward with expert medical testimony.
You mean you want a doctor to say that he got this bad condition because he shingled, hauled cement, drove truck? I mean, do we have to get down to that minute a causation, or can you just say simply this is work-related?
Well, that's what I believe happened in the Slaba construction case where there were the references to the bending, stooping, the doing the concrete work, developed through live testimony or deposition testimony where there was an element of concreteness or definiteness.
This particular one, neither expert, though, came in as a deposition in this case, did they?
No, Your Honor.
Even your expert is just a report.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Neither was subject to cross-examination or additional questions or anything like that.
And that's absolutely our point, Your Honor, and that's actually why we think that the dismissal should be affirmed, because it is the claimant's burden moving forward to establish entitlement.
Well, how far do we go in creating burdens for the employee to prove? I mean, maybe it's easier to go back into court on a negligence claim if we make this too difficult for the employee.
Your Honor, we would respectfully request that there's no need to go anywhere because we're already there, and the court has already set forth very clear guidelines. If anything, this case can stand and clarify exactly what a claimant needs to offer and send the message that an 8-line letter that doesn't refer to the condition, that doesn't refer to work-related activities, doesn't even refer to the other side in the case, doesn't even refer to the specific employer against whom benefits are sought, that kind of evidence doesn't rise to the level of establishing causation by expert medical testimony.
Going back to the Chief Justice's question, this man was involved in construction activities, basically all of his work life. Did you argue recurrence? You didn't argue a recurrence at the hearing, did you?
No, Your Honor, that's not an issue that ever came up.
So what the nature of the work activities were, whether they were this employer or another employer, is really irrelevant, unless you raised an issue of recurrence.
That's true, Your Honor, I think as a substantive matter, but focusing more so on the evidentiary burden here. And
didn't your client or clients establish what the work-related activity was? Didn't they explain what he did, that he bent over, lifted, mm-hmm. carried shingles, poured concrete, and did all these things?
Well, Your Honor, you know, as the claimant has told this court, the standard of review is de novo, and the decision is based solely upon the documentary evidence. Now, we're considering a context that's fully developed, where we have hearing testimony and we have evidence offered at the hearing. We have no indication whatsoever, though, that Dr. Carlson actually considered any of that information. And to characterize Dr. Carlson as being the primary treater who treated Dwayne Orr, the claimant, for years, I believe is a stretch of the record at the very least. The record reflects that Dr. Carlson treated the claimant periodically, and at the earliest in very late 2001.
Are you suggesting Carlson doesn't know what construction workers do?
Your Honor, what we're saying is, based upon this letter, we don't know what Dr. Carlson knows. And this court has repeatedly declined to engage in that sort of speculation or conjecture, especially where it's clear that the claimant bears the burden of proof. Your Honor, I see that my 10 minutes is expiring, and Mr. Schultz will be concluding.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schultz, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to address a couple of things that the court has asked about. And I think probably the easiest place for me to start concerning this case is probably the actual report from Dr. Carlson. Again, 8 lines. First sentence has in it, "It's not possible for me to tell." Why do we have to go farther? If it's not possible for him to tell, isn't that the end of the question? Why do we have to inquire further with him if he has already said, "I don't know"? Then, the next sentence, "If in the future we were asked," somebody in my office is smarter than me, figured out what that is. That's called the hypothetical subjunctive tense. It's the same as Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof saying, "If I were a rich man." It doesn't mean anything. That is not an expert opinion. It's a guess. That's the problem with this case. And you can see what happened with Judge ALJ Covey. She took one look at this and said, "It's not here. There's no opinion supporting a relationship between that work that that man did at that job and his degenerative disc disease." We know in this court that when you have degenerative disc disease, which is a disease that perhaps all of us have, in fact, in the Horn case, Dr. Benson testified that 80% of people have this condition, and that was in the decision. If everybody has that, then why doesn't everybody become disabled? They don't all become disabled. Some people do, some people don't. And if everybody has that, then why don't all construction workers become disabled? Because they're working. They're working in the construction job. That must mean they're going to be disabled. That's not how it works here. You have to show there's a relationship between the condition, the work that the person did, and the condition that disables them. And that's the problem with the case. Judge Covey looked at this and said, "It's not here. It's not here. End of question." However, Justice Myron, you asked about Judge Covey's point of view on the notice issue. That's important because she did make findings. She has 2 pages where she talks specifically about findings about the notice issue, but she doesn't reach it. I think Judge Bastian pointed that out. And here's what's interesting. Finding of fact 49, am I getting that right? 49 of the DOL says that these people did not know until May of 2002. The guy quits in June or July of 2001. It says in that finding of fact made by the finder of fact, not by the circuit court judge looking at a cold, wet record, finder of fact says, these people didn't know until May of 2002 that there was a work-related injury claimed here. That's an awful long time to wait to tell them. And, of course, the point is that they found out when they get a first report of injury filed in their hands from Mr. Orth. So that's a huge problem. That's what she found. She doesn't reach a conclusion of law on the notice issue because she's already said to herself, look, they didn't hear. The causation issue hasn't been met. This says right here very clearly, I cannot give, it's not possible for me to give you an opinion. She ends the inquiry there. But along the way, you'll see, right, if you carefully read her opinion, that she already is telling us, even if you get past causation somehow, I'm not buying the notice deal. And in fact, what happens on appeal is we raise that as a notice of review, and we say to Judge Eng, you know, we think this is good too. We think this is a solid basis for our position. And Judge Eng says, you're right. It is. He says, not only did they not make their proof on causation, but on the notice issue, they lose too. So this case has kind of got two major hurdles for the claimant to overcome, both of which were really set in motion at the Department of Labor level, but only one of which became, you know, obvious when Judge Eng got done with his analysis.
You don't think that the construction company knew he had back trouble when they reduced him from heavy labor to light duty, or when they reduced his work week from 5 days to four, or when he came in and said, I can't work anymore because my back hurts too much?
When he comes in and says, the reason I can't work anymore is because I got degenerative disc disease, I submit that that's what they were supposed to figure out, that he had degenerative disc disease, and that's all the further they had to go.
But they admitted at the hearing that they knew that it was work-related, didn't they?
They admitted at the hearing that they had an idea that he was complaining of back pains at work and from work, but that is not by itself, I would argue, and I submit that this court has said in the past, that's not by itself notice that they have a work-related injury. And the reason that's true is because we even had another guy show up, a coworker of his, that came to work and said, yeah, you know, I've been doing this for a while, and I got back pains too. Does that mean automatically that that is a work-related condition that's disabling?
But it puts him on notice that it's possibly it could be. Isn't that all that we require?
Well, here's the question, though. So what I'm trying to figure out then is if somebody says, my toe hurts and you're at work, does that mean you have to go look around and figure out if the guy's got a work-related condition there?
Well, if his work involves doing something with his toe, then I think that might be enough, yes.
You mean they have, see, this is my problem. I don't understand how an employer gets an affirmative burden to try to go investigate every time somebody says, I got a problem.
But here, day in, day out, they know he's got a bad back. They pull him off the roof. They put him on light duty. How far does this worker have to do? Come in and say, oh, by the way, I think I've got a degenerative back condition. There's a couple of vertebrae that aren't real good anymore. The discs are going out. I mean, why not just abolish workman's comp because no worker can meet that standard?
Well, they certainly can in this case.
A construction worker with a high school education can come in and give a medical diagnosis of his problem to his employer.
Let me tell you how it works here, okay? I think it works this way. This is how I see it, Chief Justice. This is what I'd say happens here. This man went and saw his doctor, Dr. Benson. It's in September of 2001. He's quit work already. He goes to see Dr. Benson. Dr. Benson takes a look at his x-rays and says, you didn't get that sitting down. Mr. Orth and his wife testify, yep, we knew that was a time and point in time when I knew that the doctor was telling me that I've got something going on from work. Okay, why doesn't he come in then and say, hey guys, I don't know what the deal is, but my doctor just said I didn't get this from sitting down at work, sitting down all day. There is the trigger. If nothing else, that's the trigger here. And that set of facts is in this record.
That goes to the question of what we usually see on whether the employee has an excuse for failure to report.
Right.
The fact that he has been unnoticed by his physician.
Right.
But that doesn't really go to the question of whether the employer had actual knowledge.
It does.
It's a different question, isn't it?
I'm not sure it is because I think when you the problem that I have with this, Justice Zinner, is that I think that the bottom line on this situation is that the employer, I mean, how is the employer supposed to be any better diagnostician than the claimant? I mean, how is he supposed to know anymore? I'm trying to figure out how do these guys who are probably high school educated as well, why are they supposed to know more than their workers? I mean, the person in particular knowledge here is the worker, and how does he get the knowledge? He gets it through his doctor, and that's the problem here.
So you're saying basically he's got to bring a slip back from the doctor saying not only does he have a bad back, but here's the diagnosis, and that's what the employer's entitled to.
I think that's a real good, simple way to handle these kind of things, and we don't have that here.
The purpose of the notice is so that the employer can investigate. What would your client have investigated at the time that wasn't obvious at that time. There wasn't a fall off the roof or anything like that that they could go out and take statements on, was there?
No. That's a very important point. There is no acute injury here.
So what is it that they would have done if he'd have told them that day, I'm quitting and I'm filing a work comp claim?
Here's what they do. They call their insurance company. The insurance company goes out, collects the medical records, and tries to figure out what that really means. And they try to figure out, do we have a degenerative disease? Do we have a pre-existing condition? Do we have a prior injury? What do we have here? And if so, how do we analyze it? Does it fit under the Byram theory of a condition that pre-exists that's not work-related but now has become activated by work?
And
how that happens.
What changed in the time from the time that he filed the claim and the time that he left work because he's back hurt?
What do you mean changed? I'm not sure.
What changed? How did they get disadvantaged? What couldn't they do that they did when he filed it?
Well, the difference probably is simply the continuation of the condition, although I'm not sure how much he deteriorated. He said he got worse as time went on. In terms of the freshness of the information, I'm not sure there would be a lot of change there, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily the criteria. Has there been a disadvantage posed by the delay? I'm not sure that's there. I'm sorry, my time is up.
I was letting you answer the question.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think I've answered it. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I guess I would just make two quick points. The first, I think Judge Gores was getting at, is that the purpose of the notice statute is not something that creates a substantive right in the employer to escape from responsibility for paying for a compensable workers' comp claim. The notice statute is a very important statute, but what it's intended to do is just to ensure that there's an opportunity to invest these claims. It's not an escape hatch. It's not a free pass. If there's a compensable work claim, and an employer is alerted to the possibility that there might be a work-related injury so that he has the opportunity to conduct an investigation, then the notice statute doesn't apply. And that's right in the statute. And I would suggest that the record is overwhelmingly clear that both individual employers who work side by side with this gentleman understood that his work was affecting his back, understood that, very candidly admitted that. These are two great employers. They treat their workers great. They're wonderful men. They admitted it. They admit, yes, we understood, we knew.
So is this clearly erroneous, this finding number 49? May 20th, 2002 was the first time the employer became aware the claimant was claiming to have sustained a work-related injury.
I think, yes, it's clearly erroneous. But in addition, what that simply says is that on the date that the workers' comp case was filed, that's when they first knew. It depends on how you define no.
Is that the date when it was filed?
I believe.
The notice.
The report of injury. I believe so.
That's what the finding of fact 48 says that.
It depends on how you define no. That's when they knew he was making a claim for workers' comp, yes. But that's not what the notice statute, that's not the test under the notice statute. Notice statute is when were they alerted of the possibility that an injury might be work-related. And so I think it's clearly erroneous if you interpret it the way that they're asking you to interpret it. But on its face, it just simply says that's when they knew he was making a claim. On causation, I hope we don't get to the point where every causation issue has to be fully litigated. Here we have both sides agreeing that we have medical records and expert testimony that can be put in the record and examined by the ALJ. And that was done. We believe that the testimony or the medical opinion letter by Dr. Carlson was misunderstood by the ALJ. Mr. Schultz suggests that you have to stop reading after it is not possible. Stop reading. And I think that's what the ALJ did. The judge stopped reading and didn't read the entire opinion. Because if you finish the sentence, what it says is, it is not possible for me to determine which of the work-related injuries and the degenerative changes is the major contributing cause. However, if you're asking, or if I'm asked in the future, is how Dr. Carlson put it in his unique use of language there, to apportion these two, I would give it 50% work and 50% degenerative changes. And I'm basing that, as he says at the beginning of his letter, on my treatment of this man, my treatment of his injuries, my examination of the medical histories, of his medical history, the medical records, and the medical records are there in the record, and they were there before the department as well. And so I would suggest that on this record, causation has been established. And I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Burson. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.